Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to look at the Syrian Revolt of 1925, where the city of Damascus and the Syrian people rose up against French colonial rule. The long story of this is based around the Paris Peace Conference and the mandates, and it goes even back earlier than that. If we go back to 1915 and the Sykes-Picot-Sazonov agreement, which was the agreement between the Sir Mark Sykes and Georges Picot and Sazonov, their Russian counterpart, to divide up the Middle East. In James Barr's excellent book, A Line in the Sand, it talks an awful lot about the Sykes-Picot agreement and how the French believe themselves to have a long-standing historical claim on Syria, dating all the way back to the Crusades. I have had the good fortune many years ago to stand on the battlements of French Crusader castles, looking out down the Bekaa Valley. So you get a sense of how far back there had been a French colonial presence in Syria. The French claimed Syria after at the Paris Peace Conference, based on the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and they saw the possible influence of Britain in Syria as a mortal threat. The French had rather hoped they would get Palestine as well. Palestine originally was then allocated to be an international mandate and then fell into British hands. And in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, where Britain established itself, much to the outrage of France when they realised that one of the key cities of Mesopotamia would be Mosul, where the British knew there was oil, and the British traded Mosul for Syria. The French felt utterly cheated. And so the two powers spent the best part of 2.5 decades interfering with one another's control over these mandates in the Middle East. The mandates, of course, were meant to be a means by which colonial powers could help the less developed nations to reach a level of self-governance. There were different categories of mandate, and the Arab countries were seen as Category B mandates, so they would eventually be ready for self-rule in maybe a matter of decades. The British, of course, didn't see it like that. Neither did the French. They saw these as de facto colonies that they were determined to hold on for as long as possible. So today we're looking at The Guardians by Susan Peterson, which we've looked at briefly before. And here we're on Chapter 5, Bombing Damascus. And Susan Peterson writes, "Officially the French insisted that the Syrian revolt of 1925 had no deep causes. It was just the work of brigands and agitators who took advantage of a rising in the ever volatile Jabal Druze to prey on vulnerable villages and harry French forces. Most observers at the time, however, not to mention virtually all historians since, saw early Mandate Syria as a tinderbox of discontents, which even the slightest spark could burst into flame. Except amongst the Christian population of Mount Lebanon, resentment against the French presence was near universal, and in Syria, feelings against the creation of Greater Lebanon and the division of the rest of the country into four separate statelets ran high." Lebanon was an artificially created Christian state in the Middle East, created by the French, which had traditionally always been part of Syria. Syrian notables educated in the West or at Ottoman schools and accustomed to running their own local administrations deeply resented orders that made the actions of every local official subject to French approval. Syrian military officers were offended when forced to accept commissions far below their Ottoman ranks. French economic policy also hit the population hard, for France pegged the new Syrian pound to the unstable franc, creating serious inflation. It's fascinating that when you look at the American occupation of Iraq from 2003 onwards, almost every mistake made by Syria in that paragraph is replicated by America. The Iraqi bureaucracy and army quite happy to consider a change of regime. No specific loyalty to Saddam Hussein, but outraged when, firstly, fundamental structures of government are abolished, and then the army itself is simply dissolved, and officers with many, many years of experience in all sorts of things like bomb making, for example, are dismissed without the possibility of a pension, whilst lining up and hoping that the Americans were actually ready to create a new regime. Apparently not. Finally, as luck would have it, writes Susan Peterson, in 1924 was a year of drought and bad harvests, sowing hardship and anxiety among populations for whom the memory of the wartime famine was still very real. So the shorter-term causes were numerous. In Jabal Druze, one of the semi-autonomous statelets created by France in 1921, which lasted till 1936, there was an opportunity for the whole volatile mixture of Syrian politics to really ignite. Gabriel Carbinet, a French officer with experience in West Africa, had been appointed in 1923 as the local governor of Jabal Druze. He was described here as an authoritarian, active fellow, and possibly slightly deranged. Carbinet saw the Jabal Druze through a framework of medieval feudalism and took it upon himself to emancipate its serfs through an ambitious programme of road construction, school building and land reform. Unable to persuade peasants of the usefulness of his plans, and without the money to hire them, he made extensive and unlawful use of forced labour, which is a novel way of trying to end serfdom, I suppose. When individuals protested, they received summary chastisement. Minor acts of resistance, including in a case that became famous, the disappearance of one officer's cat, elicited collective punishments and fines. Druze sheikhs who remonstrated were set to road breaking or locked up. So enormous humiliations for tribal and religious leaders. By the spring of 1925, unrest had reached such a pitch that the High Commissioner sent this Kurtz-like figure off to France for a holiday. Drew's notables and the intelligence officers at the Service de Renseignement advised his permanent removal. So this is interesting. And occasionally in colonial histories, you find characters like this, figures who embrace their colonial roles with a zeal above and beyond anything that's asked for them, and often a level of brutality and sadism. Some who have this kind of transformative idea, which is inherently sort of chauvinistic and racist, the idea that A, the local people can't do things for themselves, and B, the things that the local people are doing are the wrong things, and they should be really looking to modernise, to advance and to refashion their country along the lines that the coloniser recognises as being proper or good. The man who would consider the calls for Kabylie to be removed was Maurice Sorel, who was the High Commissioner. And Sorel was actually such a negative impact on the Jebel Druze situation that he began to actually do more to fan the flames. He is described here as an unusual figure in the French army, anti-clerical, Freemason, and a war hero to boot, and a figure of the kind of the political left. He'd been appointed by the new Cartel de Gauche government in late 1924 to replace the Catholic Maxime Weygand, an act roundly criticised by the French right as driven only by party considerations. Weygand himself was immensely brutal in Syria, a figure who waged war against tribal leaders and believed that Syria was a place to be brought into line by France. So yes, he replaced Maxime Weygand, an act roundly criticised by the French right as driven only by party considerations. And indeed, within days of his arrival in Beirut, Sorel had alienated Lebanese Christians. Determined to follow a policy of impartiality, which the political right saw as really leniency towards Syrian Muslims, Sorel proposed free elections and allowed Syrian parties to form, which saw the development of the Syrian People's Party under the leadership of Abdelrahman Shahbah Handar, who was the former foreign minister of Prince Faisal, formerly Prince Faisal of Syria, and later Prince Faisal of Iraq. Faisal, son of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, was given the role of King of Syria and was later turfed out by the French and sent to Iraq, where he via Palestine, and was able to establish himself as the monarch of Iraq. So, despite the fact that the possibilities of free elections and a multi-party democracy emerged, the Druze sheikhs and the more modern, forward-thinking nationalists in Damascus learned very quickly that Sorel had no interest in a real challenge to his authority.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Sections that he proposed would have been a highly tame affair. To show his commitment, or lack thereof, to meaningful democracy, in July 1925, Sorel instructed his officials in Damascus to lure the Druze chiefs to Damascus on the pretext of hearing their complaints and their resentments, at which point, when they were assembled in one place, he arrested them and had them exiled from the country. So the most militantly anti-French leader in the Jebel Druze, Sultan al-Atrash, saw this as the final insult, and he had been a long-term enemy of the French, and had opposed the administration's 1921 deal with the Druze, and had continued to carry on a guerrilla war from Transjordan throughout 1922. It would have been the British that had kicked him out of Transjordan in 1923. And only after that did he sort of submit to French authority and promise to be good. However, this humiliation, which didn't feature him, he had chosen wisely not to attend bash thrown by Sorel. He saw that as being the great dishonour. On the 18th of July 1925, Druze Highlanders brought down a French airplane, and 4 days later, a band under al-Atrash's command engaged a column of between 150 and 250 French colonial troops, killing most of them. Al-Atrash's forces suffered losses as well, but this early success brought men flocking to his ranks. By the end of July, he'd captured Soweda, which was the main Druze town, and when the French sent 3,000 men under General Roger Michaud to relieve it, the column was also cut to pieces. And at that point, all of Syria knows of Al-Atrash's victory over the French. So this suddenly becomes an existential challenge to French rule in Syria. The French have to destroy al-Atrash and defeat him conclusively. Otherwise, it transforms into a national rising, which, in fact, it actually does. Over the following 3 months, the Syrians, who are inspired by the example of al-Atrash, fight with him. And so this begins to take a slightly different course from other Arab revolts. In previous Arab revolts, if you look at the Arab revolt of 1916 against the Ottoman Empire, Arab notables, Arab leaders, Sharif Hussein of Mecca, for example, would call Arabs of lower social ranks to flock to the banner. But in this instance, something else is happening. Men from lesser, more middling sorts of Syrian Arab men from less prestigious backgrounds are the organisers and the inspirers and the kind of the nodes within the revolt. Often they had been either in the Ottoman army or to Ottoman military school, and they understood fighting and they understood and were quickly able to adapt this to new kinds of guerrilla warfare. The French never quite got this, and they never quite understood that Al-Atrash was more than simply an Arab warlord. The French colonial chauvinistic way of looking at this was he is just another Arab who will eventually lead his people to rack and ruin, or he's just an Arab like a tribal chief. But he's not. He is somebody quite steeped in modern nationalist ideas, an educated man. He'd been a young Ottoman army conscript in the Balkans before the First World War, and he'd later joined the Arab Revolt. So he had experience alongside Faisal of fighting against the Turks. By mid-August 1925, he was in touch with Shabandar and the People's Party in Damascus, and on the 23rd of August, as commander of the Syrian Revolutionary Armies, he issued a general call to arms, appealing to all Syrians to remember your forefathers, your history, your heroes, your martyrs, your national honour. Remember the civilised nations that are united cannot be destroyed. Al-Atrash called for the complete independence of Syria, the institution of free elections and popular government, and the expulsion of foreign armies from Syrian soil. And in an interesting touch, the application of the principles of the French Revolution and the rights of man. So a modern and forward-looking figure who was saying much of what the later forebears in various national liberation movements around the world in the 20th century would have said: free elections, popular government, and the expulsion of foreign armies from Syrian soil. Of course, we see in the period from 1917 to 1919, an extraordinary colonisation of the Arab world, the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, the humbling and the humiliation of the Turks, with as foreign soldiers occupying key points in Constantinople, all the way to foreign armies in places like Armenia, the colonisation of most of North Africa, which had obviously been ongoing since the 19th century, and the evisceration of the Ottoman Empire. Well, not only do you get Turkish nationalism, but upsurges of Arab nationalism and the desire for self-determination, obviously, in Arab countries too. Exploiting the long-standing alliances between the grain-producing villages of southern Syria, writes Susan Peterson, and the Damascene merchants, the revolt spread. Friendships forged in Ottoman military schools drove it northwards. In August and September 1925, insurgent bands penetrated the Garden District around Damascus. In October, Fawzi al-Kawakshi, a former Ottoman army officer, who was now captain in the French Legion, mutinied together with his men and joined with Bedouin bands to seize Hama, 200 kilometres north of Damascus. The French, rattled short of men and facing an enemy they couldn't clearly see, turned to Circassian, Kurdish and Armenian irregulars to do the work of sweeping into villages, rooting out suspected rebels. tells the spread of rampant violence and rapacity of those troops, who openly hawked their looted goods in Damascus. Heavy use was also made of aerial bombardment. Once again, you know, as a well repeated trope, that the British kept troublesome tribes in line using aerial bombing and poison gas, and so did the French. So Hama was heavily bombed, where notables forced the insurgents to withdraw following a prolonged shelling that prolonged aerial bombardment that took several hundred lives. So Susan Peterson writes, "This was a vicious, ugly war. One morning in early October, Damascenes woke up to find French troops parading the corpses of a few dozen ostensible rebels through their streets and then stringing them up for public view in the Margot Square." And it has kind of sort of echoes of the later horrors of Algeria, which once again is something hopefully we'll get to in the coming year. 3 days later, insurgents dumped the bodies of 12 Circassians outside the city's eastern gate. With both insurgents and irregulars active in the city, on the 18th of October, the French sent tanks careening through the narrow streets that even began a bombardment. And that evening began a bombardment, sorry. Next day, all troops were withdrawn, and for the next 2 days, Damascus was under fire from live shells and airplanes. And it was this point that the real international outcry began. And we will come to that in the not-too-distant future. Towards the end of the Second World War, the British, who had liberated, along with free French forces, had liberated Syria earlier in the war from Vichy France. The British actually have to cross over with an armed column into free French-ruled Damascus in order to confine the French army to barracks because of the levels of violence and abuses against the Syrian population and the fury with which an anti-colonial uprising was put down, and the demand for free elections and independence after World War II. Now, this isn't to necessarily to paint British colonialism in a rosy light, far from it, but it does give you a sense of kind of perspective on how violent French colonialism in Syria actually was, if the British army have to intervene and encourage some sort of sense of decency and restraint. Probably Britain was more motivated by the fear that Arab unrest would spread throughout the Middle East and cause everybody, every colonial power, a lot of trouble. Probably. Anyway, I hope you found that useful and interesting. It's the first podcast of a new year, so we're going to try to really kind of pick up the pace a bit. Last year, the coronavirus, unfortunately, meant that there was a lot less I could do, but we're back on it now. We're back on it now. Anyway, stay safe, look after yourselves, and I hope that whatever lockdowns are about to be put under won't last too long. Take good care. Come and check us out at the Explaining History Facebook group, and if you can possibly support Explaining History on Patreon, we're always very, very grateful for that. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.